Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the Trump team grows, Tennessee inferno, carrier jobs, no charges in Charlotte. Last night in Cincinnati, President-elect Donald Trump announced retired Marine General James Mattis as his latest cabinet pick.
We are going to appoint Mad Dog Mattis as our Secretary of Defense.
In Tennessee, Gatlinburg burned, and Michael Luciano drove down a mountain in flames with his dog Red at his side.
No warning, nothing. Not one single warning on the news. And you're telling me nobody knew. Almost every cabin in Chalet Village is burning to the freaking ground.
And Charlotte, North Carolina District Attorney Andrew Murray announced no charges against Officer Brentley Vinson in the fatal shooting of Keith Lamont Scott.
It is my opinion that Officer Vinson acted lawfully when he shot Mr. Scott.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Glenn Thrush, Kelsey Snell, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your take on President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks? And do you think Trump can keep American jobs from moving abroad? Done it with Carrier, how far does that go? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Glenn Thrush, chief political correspondent for Politico and staff writer for Politico magazine. Glenn, great to have you back right here.
Great to be here.
Also with us from Washington, Kelsey Snell, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Kelsey, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Glenn, and Kelsey.
Glenn, let's go straight to this team that is shaping up. Mad Dog Mattis, we heard Donald Trump celebrating in Cincinnati yesterday. Headlines here from your paper, Kelsey. Donald Trump's assembling the richest administration in modern history. Glenn, look across the landscape of who's been named. What do you see emerging?
Well, apart from the initial set of appointments, namely Steve Bannon to be the counselor to the president, this is a fairly conventional, one would almost say back to the future, assemblage. You know, we got a lot of generals. We got a lot of generals under consideration. We have David Petraeus, who I think is emerging now as one of the serious contenders for Secretary of State. We have former General Flynn, who is going to be running the NSC, and now we have General Mattis at the Defense Department. The one thing that I would say that it says about defense is over the past 8 years, really over the past 10 years, we have seen a centralization of decision-making about defense and the armed forces in the White House, in the West Wing. This is largely a product of the post-Rumsfeld era when President Bush began aggregating power in the West Wing on the National Security Staff. We are going to see, I think the Mattis appointment, I think, makes this very, very clear. We're going to see a devolution of power from the West Wing, from the White House, back to the Pentagon. And that is a significant development that I think, A, has some unpredictable outcomes, and B, pretty much sets up a potential conflict between General Flynn at NSC and General Mattis at the Pentagon.
I mean, I wonder how you do that. For example, now we've got retired Marine General James Mattis coming in as defense secretary. We've got an Iran agreement. I guess he says he doesn't want to blow that up. But here he was talking about Iran as the number one threat in the region. This was a speech in April, last April, during the U.S. negotiations over the nuclear agreement. And here he was calling Iran basically the region's top threat.
The Iranian regime, in my mind, is the single most enduring threat to stability and peace in the Middle East. For all of ISIS and al-Qaeda's mention everywhere right now, they're an immediate threat. They're serious. Certainly Assad's Syria and what it's spewing out is a very serious threat. But nothing, I believe, is as serious in the long-term enduring ramifications in terms of stability and prosperity and some hope for a better future for the young people out there than Iran.
Glenn, so what does this mean? Does it mean the White House farming military policy out to the Pentagon after having brought it close in the Obama administration?
Look, I think the one thing that is clear is that we don't know. We have a president. We saw him addressing a rally in Cincinnati. So we now have one victory rally for two intelligence briefings that he's accepted. So we don't know what this guy is going to do. The one thing I would say about the Iran agreement is we now have an interesting dynamic. We have a fairly – what's regarded as a fairly Democratic-owned Iran agreement that has been viciously criticized by Republicans in the Senate and the House and also Donald Trump. And in Mattis, we kind of have a tough guy on Iran. But here's where it gets interesting. Essentially, I don't think you're going to find a single person on the Obama national security team that disagrees with Mattis's assessment about Iran posing a long-term threat. The question is, how do you deal with it? And what is really interesting here is Iran is as divided as the United States. You have the old hardline Revolutionary Guard who are real hawks who keep doing the death to America riff in order to kind of whip up support for themselves. And you have a much younger generation. Rouhani, the president, represents that generation, trying to liberalize. So the question here is, does Mattis, if he takes a very hard line against Iran, empower hardliners in Tehran? There's a lot of moving parts here.
And that's just defense. Kelsey Snell, you're watching all this from Capitol Hill, as is Congress. What kind of reception are you hearing for the team that Donald Trump is putting together so far? We've got Elaine Chao at Transportation, Tom Price at Health and Human Services, very anti-Affordable Care Act, Wilbur Ross, worth almost $3 billion as Commerce Secretary, and, of course, Steve Mnuchin, coming in at Treasury, Goldman Sachs guy. How is Congress looking at the team that Donald Trump's putting together?
Well, conservatives in Congress are very pleased, actually. Tom Price is well-liked in the House, very well-liked among his colleagues, and is expected to have a very easy confirmation. In fact, most of these domestic policy nominations that we've seen so far are very likely to get through the Senate without much in the way of pushback. I think that the one problem that we might run into here is with Mnuchin, because I think there is a visceral reaction coming from a lot of Democrats against him. We saw a story today from the AP that about Trump supporters saying that they lost their home to some of his dealings. And you're
he bought a bank. The bank foreclosed on a lot of people.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have a personal connection to him in a way that they don't with other people who have been nominated. The one issue that we will certainly see with Tom Price is that he has a very conventionally conservative response to replacing the Affordable Care Act. He wants to create a voucher-like system to replace Medicaid and Medicare and to get people out of the exchanges and back into the private market. But he also has a really strong emphasis on people spending their own money on health care.
Replace Medicare. That's a big deal. Is that really what he has in mind? Here's some money. Good luck. Go.
He wants to replace Obamacare entirely. And the Medicare side of it, his idea is he wants to make more privatization of that, Medicare.
Jack Beatty, what do you see emerging in the cabinet so far?
Well, let's just stop with Mr. Price for a moment. He does want to, or he has been one of the leading proponents of, quote, reforming Medicare, which means voucherizing at least part of it, and perhaps more than that. And the Democrats this week greeted that as a boon. Chuck Schumer said, bring it on. Let us have that issue. And Paul Ryan responded, oh, there are the Democrats again with Medi-Scare. They're going to try to frighten seniors into voting for them. Well, we'll have to see how that turns out. But that's an extremely controversial move for the Trump administration, because the Democrats feel it gives them a powerful issue to work. But second on Price, Paul Krugman points today to how many Trump voters would stand to lose if he radically, reshapes or eliminates most of Obamacare. For example, under the Obamacare program, Krugman calculates about 13 million. The uninsured rate dropped by 13 million. Whites without a college degree accounted for 8 million of that 13 million, and those voters went for Trump by 2-1. So he calculates at least that as many as 5 million Trump voters stand to lose something, either a subsidy or if they're on Medicaid, direct government coverage. If the ideology and programming that he favored in the House, if he's able to do that as a secretary.
I mean, maybe they'll be for that if they see the draining of the swamp that Donald Trump promised on the campaign trail. But here, Kelsey, your newspaper, the Wonk Blog, is reporting, you know, richest administration in modern history, billionaires aplenty in this lineup, and you've got Goldman Sachs, of course, all over Steve Mnuchin's background. What about the drain the swamp promise? What that meant and what it appears to mean now with this lineup? Are these guys who are going to come in and fundamentally change things?
I don't really think that that is what we're seeing here. The drain the swamp has not really materialized in any way. I wanted to go back a little bit to what was being said about Price and Obamacare. Mm-hmm. I actually, just to follow up a little bit, is, you know, I think one of the most astute comments that we've seen out of a member of Congress so far was earlier this week, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy pointed out that while it will likely only take 50 votes in the Senate to repeal Obamacare, it will take 60 votes to replace it. And Republicans are only going to have 52 votes. So they are going to have to come up with some sort of replacement plan that can recruit at least 8 Democrats. And that is a huge lift that I don't think has been well considered yet in all of this talk about what will happen with the future of healthcare in America.
Glenn, how about it? What's the response you're hearing in Washington to big change? This was supposed to be a protest vote against concentrated power in Washington, the power of money. Is this cabinet that's coming together look like one that will get out the shovel and clean that barn?
Looks like a Goldman Sachs alumni dinner. I mean, it really is. I mean, it is amazing to consider how much ink was spilt on this question of Hillary Clinton's private speeches to Goldman Sachs and how much political hay Donald Trump made out of it. Look, in terms of the promise-keeping aspect of the Trump campaign, you know, we now know why he was so vague. We now know why when you went on his website, you couldn't find any policy. There wasn't any. I mean, he was going for whatever message was going to get him elected, and I think we're seeing the fallout from that right now.
Well, we'll dig in and see what that looks like, what it may look like with the picks still to come. Big promises around jobs, and this week, Donald Trump jawboning Carrier in Indiana. Well, Mike Pence, of course, is still governor, into keeping jobs there. How did he do that? This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news. Trump's team, Tennessee wildfire, election recount, Fidel Castro, and more with Glenn Thrush of Politico, Kelsey Snell of The Washington Post. Jack Beatty's here, and you are very welcome to join us. How do you read the Carrier deal on jobs out of Indiana? How do you read the president-elect's tweets this week on flag burning, on his charge of illegal voting? And have you lived through the burning of Gatlinburg, Tennessee? What do you see in that fire in the week's November tornadoes? Donald Trump announcing yesterday before a cheering crowd in Cincinnati that he was going to keep jobs at Carrier in Indiana, and companies are just not going to leave without consequences anymore. Here he was talking.
Companies are not going to leave the United States anymore without consequences. Not going to happen.
Okay, that from the floor of the Carrier plant in Indianapolis yesterday. Kelsey Snell, here we go. How did Donald Trump pull this off?
Well, it was done in large part with a tax break from the state of Indiana. And, you know, the reaction that I'm hearing a lot from people in Congress is worry that this sets a precedent that is unsustainable. Particularly, we're hearing from Democrats like Senator Bernie Sanders, who said that essentially United Technologies, which was part of this Carrier deal, took Trump hostage and won. The response being that, you know, if you're going to hand out tax breaks every time a company threatens to leave, that companies will just threaten to leave so they can get tax breaks. And, you know, companies are very, very good at figuring out ways to lower their tax burden. The response, though, from Republicans like House Speaker Paul Ryan is that this just proves that the U.S. needs to do comprehensive tax reform. And the goal is for them to be doing that sometime as early as, you know, middle of next year.
I want to sort of try and get closer to this because my understanding was, listening to NPR News this morning, that they were already offered that tax break before the election by Indiana and had declined to make a change in their plans to move those jobs. Now they're moving them. United Technologies, the parent company of Carrier, has some very substantial Pentagon contracts. Glenn, do we know how or whether that was used as leverage to keep these Carrier jobs in the U.S.?
Well, we do have a sense that this was – definitely part of the company's calculation in this. And I should say, people like Don Evans, who was Secretary of Commerce under George W. Bush, has said that this is not the kind of deal that you can really have as a precedent. You can't have the president making individual small deals with the companies. And, you know, Tom, I covered tax incentives, particularly for real estate and corporate retention, as a reporter covering New York City and even Alabama. I remember writing a story about the tax incentives. I think it was $50 or $100 million that Alabama gave to retain a Mercedes plant. These are sloppy, sloppy deals. And oftentimes the fine print of these deals is not as advantageous as the original press release. And the other thing about it is I was kind of jarred because visuals with Donald Trump are everything. You know, his staff says that he's far more concerned about the visuals of events than necessarily the words.
I mean, he promised these jobs wouldn't go, and something like 1,000 of them are not going.
And, of course, a bunch of them are still going to Mexico. But I was also struck, and I'd be interested in hearing what the other panelists thought about this, by the prospect of the president-elect of the United States essentially standing in front of a Carrier ad. His podium said Carrier on it. It said Carrier behind him. I mean, this company, if you look at the 1,000 jobs, they got $7 million from the state of Indiana. What is the calculation of the amount of advertising, free advertising, the soon-to-be president of the United States gave them yesterday at this event?
I don't know. I mean, this sounds kind of penny-ante to me. We're looking at national policy on keeping jobs from going abroad. Maybe it's a big deal for them. But I wonder, I mean, Jack Kelsey says that United Technologies, the parent company, has taken Trump hostage here. But who's taken whom hostage? I mean, he's got them over a barrel maybe for their defense contracts. We don't really know. There's not full transparency about what was said between the president-elect and this company.
No, and, you know, what we do see here is a blatant violation of free market economics. And some of us say good thing. I mean, those of us who are for the auto bailout, I mean, the same sort of logic applied there, although that was much, much, much bigger, to save American jobs. That was the central part of Trump's campaign message. That's what really caught, he did so well in the upper Midwest because of that. And that's a break from Republican Wall Street Journal orthodoxy. And, you know, if he can make good on that or better on that by generalizing this kind of deal, even if it means tax breaks, of course, that requires, you know, in a way that saves the jobs, but it puts the it shifts the burden onto the taxpayer who has to pick it up. But nevertheless, that shows a willingness to engage in what used to be anathema for conservatives, industrial policy.
Of course, how you jawbone all those companies out there who could potentially move jobs abroad. But maybe if you can get the economy fired up, maybe you don't have to at a certain point. Liz in New York, Saratoga Springs, New York. Thank you for calling. Liz, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I happen to agree with the prospect that Donald Trump has sold out the workers, and he has not. He only saved less than 1,000 jobs, but what a great cost to the taxpayers of Indiana and the huge tax break he has given the corporation. I happen to agree with Bernie Sanders' aspect on this, that the company has held the government hostage till they got the tax breaks they were looking for, because they have asked for these before, and now he has rewarded them for not taking less than 1,000 jobs away. He has not punished them for taking the 1,200 jobs away.
Yeah, and it will cost. It will cost. Liz, I appreciate that. Of course, we don't know exactly what the full cost is here or what was promised or threatened entirely here, and that's interesting in itself. Before we get off the cabinet, I want to go back to Mitt Romney. That's been such an interesting back and forth this week. Mitt Romney, who was highly critical of Donald Trump during the campaign, and then again this week talking with Trump about the Secretary of State position. Here he was coming out Tuesday night after they met over dinner in New York, frog legs and more, we're told, talking about his conversation with Donald Trump.
I had a wonderful evening with President-elect Trump. We had another discussion about affairs throughout the world, and these discussions I've had with him have been enlightening, and interesting and engaging.
Enlightening, interesting, engaging. Amazing to see those photos of Romney and Trump over dinner there. But from Trump's own camp, we had Kellyanne Conway saying, hey, wait a minute. People feel betrayed at the president-elect, who she's close to, talking with Governor Romney.
People feel betrayed to think that Governor Romney, who went out of his way to question the character and the intellect and the integrity of Donald Trump, now our president-elect, would be given the most significant cabinet post of all, Secretary of State. And that is a decision that only one man can make. President-elect Donald Trump, I will respect it and I will support it 1,000%. But I'm reflecting what the grassroots are saying.
I'll support it 1,000%, but people feel betrayed. What's going on here, Glenn? Is Governor Romney under serious consideration? Is he being played? What about this apparent dissent within the Trump camp?
I think he is both under serious consideration and being played. I think you're seeing something extraordinary, two extraordinary developments here. The first is Donald Trump is going to do a lot of this stuff in public. This is going to be like that big, long conference table on The Apprentice. That is his, you know, that is his template for this kind of decision making. There is simply nothing known as kind of private for this guy. And then the other equally extraordinary thing is you have a president who, and I'm not describing this as a diagnosis, but I'm just reflecting my conversations with a lot of his senior people, has, in terms of policy and briefing, a form of political attention deficit disorder. You can't sit with the guy and have him read a 50-page briefing book or even a 3-page briefing paper. So communicating your opinion to him or getting him to understand your facts is a very difficult and arduous process to do behind closed doors. What he does pay attention to is the media. He pays attention to CNN. He pays attention to the New York Times. And when he hears something through those media – and by the way, if you look on the internet, you'll just see dozens of pictures of the guy watching TV. So then in order for his top aides to get penetration, in order for them to get their opinions heard, they have to use the media to get to him. It's extraordinary, and I don't think this is the last time we're going to see
it. It's not the first time we've seen that either. I mean, we had plenty of other presidents who watched the media and took a lot away from that.
But it seems like for Trump, the media is the principal and in some cases the exclusive conduit for the delivery of that information. And the fascinating thing, we saw dueling stories, in my publication and the New York Times on whether or not Kellyanne Conway was in trouble for this. And the answer is maybe. It seems that Trump appreciated the fact that she's sort of advocating for him and the grassroots folks who got him there. He may not be as appreciative in the long term being called out. But it gets back to your basic question. What does he intend to do? And I do think Kellyanne Conway's push, along with Steve Bannon internally, really against Mitt Romney, has opened up the process perhaps to a third candidate. And it seems, over the last few days at least, that candidate is David Petraeus.
That seems like the most likely at this point.
It's hard. Who the heck can say?
Yeah.
I mean, but I think, you know, from what we're hearing internally in the way that this is breaking down, Rudy Giuliani has faded significantly, the former mayor of New York City, who really has gone on an extraordinary self-congratulatory tour here, that he's sort of faded. And at the moment, barring the emergence of a third candidate who would likely be Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker, it looks like the two strongest candidates are Petraeus and Romney.
I want to go back to that thank you rally in Cincinnati yesterday. Donald Trump talking there about we have to be an inclusive and loving society, but with a pretty sharp zing for those, he said, who would hate us in terms of coming into this country. Here was Trump before the crowds in Cincinnati yesterday.
We're going to seek a truly inclusive society where we support each other, love each other, and look out for each other. And that means that people coming into our country have to be people that have the potential to love us, not to hate us.
We have to love each other. So only bring people who will love us, don't hate us. There's some tension there. And he went on to say, and maybe this was to try and tamp down some of the alt-right stuff or respond to criticism that he hasn't, to condemn bigotry and hatred.
We condemn bigotry and prejudice in all of its forms. We denounce all of the hatred, and we forcefully reject the language of exclusion and separation. We're going to come together. We have no choice. We have to, and it's better. It's better.
Kelsey Snell, what about that language? What's the implication there in terms of immigration policy? And what about the larger message of love versus division, acceptance versus division from this president-elect?
Well, on the issue of immigration, I think it is being read by many people as furthering his, you know, his thoughts about banning any immigrants from Muslim countries. And I think that, you know, that creates a little bit of fear among people who worry that, you know, that he's trying to soften the language while still sticking to the central idea of preventing people who come from countries where we have conflicts or where, you know, where we have seen terrorist attacks coming into the United States. And I think that Democrats are very on guard about this and are already pushing back. On the issue of the new, kinder, gentler, loving approach, I think that, you know, maybe he is recognizing that people worry about the bigotry that they have seen from some of his supporters. I think that there has been a lot of coverage of that. And if we do believe that he gets most of his guidance from what he sees on television and what he reads in print, then maybe this is just him recognizing that the coverage has not been good and that people worry about, you know, how he will approach things when he comes into office. There's also something to be said for the negative coverage that has, you know, that has gone his way because of his choice of Steve Bannon as a chief strategist. I think that, you know, Donald Trump is very, very aware of how he is perceived, and he is trying to avoid walking in the door, you know, with a mountain of criticism that he could maybe try to avoid.
Interesting moment yesterday at Harvard University, the Trump campaign teams and the Hillary Clinton campaign team sort of sitting elbow to elbow there talking about the campaign that had just passed. The campaigns have done that every 4 years for many years now. There was a moment where at that conclave at the Institute of Politics there at Harvard where Jennifer Palmieri, the Clinton campaign's director of communications, criticized the Trump campaign for providing a platform to white supremacists. She said she'd rather lose than win that way. And you can hear Kellyanne Conway, Trump's final campaign manager, jumping in to respond.
I would rather lose than win the way you guys did.
No, you wouldn't.
Yes.
No, you wouldn't.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
No, that's very clear today. No, you wouldn't, respectfully. I'm sorry. So, how exactly did we win? No, go for it, Jen. How exactly did we win? I'd like to know because I've sacrificed the last 4 months of my life to do it. Excuse me. And we did it. And we did it by looking at the schedule and looking at, yes, the electoral map of 270, because that's how you win the presidency.
That's how you win the presidency. Jack Beattie's elbow still very sharp there yesterday. The white supremacist thing put out and the Clinton people saying, we don't want to win the way you did. Kellyanne Conway not buying it and pushing back saying, well, if Hillary Clinton had had a stronger message on the economy, maybe you wouldn't be sitting where you are. But wow, the razor sharp elbows still totally humming there, Jack.
Yes, and who can blame people on either side? I mean, I think Palmieri is right. I think they did appeal to the white nationalist vote, but so was Kellyanne Conway. There was no Clinton message that I'm aware of to the white working class, and indeed, in her enumeration of groups in the society, she often left that category of person, a numerous category, out.
And so there we are, Glenn Thrush. I guess is this where the hatchet gets buried, or how does that tension unfold over the coming years?
Oh, there's no burying of this hatchet. This is the enlivening counterattack spirit of the Democratic resurgence. I mean, if they lose this anger, they're done. You know, the one thing I think we need to say here, and I think this is really given a little wind in the sails of the defeated Democrats, is we just keep watching every single day the number of popular votes that Hillary Clinton is leading by nationally. We're up to close to 2.5 million. She's likely to be 2% nationally ahead. Now, look, that's a horseshoes and hand grenades thing. The Electoral College is the only thing that matters. This is the least popular elected president we have seen in 150 years, and a guy who a third of his own supporters who voted for him don't like him, disapprove of him. So he does not have a mandate. And I think my takeaway from the Harvard thing, and I'm really upset I had a stomach virus and I missed it, is the sense that the Trump team is still doing its victory lap. They've got a country to govern, and they don't have a heck of a large mandate to do it.
And yet, Kelsey, you heard a heck of a lot of hollering and support in that arena in Cincinnati yesterday, as Donald Trump knows, and that's the image that went out.
Sure. And I think, you know, Glenn touches on something that's really important here, is that the lack of mandate may also make it very difficult for Trump to successfully push through the policies that he has promised. And I think a lot of his voters are looking to, we heard often that people did not take him exactly literally, but when it comes to policies, they will want to see some results. And with a lack of mandate, it'll be hard to get those things through Congress.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the plane carrying a much-loved Brazilian soccer team crashed when it ran out of fuel over Colombia. 71 died. NPR's John Otis reported on the final conversation between air traffic control in Medellin and pilot Miguel Quiroga.
She asked Quiroga how long can he remain in a holding pattern. Quiroga replies, "We have a fuel emergency, miss. That's why I'm asking for an immediate landing."
They did not get an immediate landing. They crashed. As winter descends on North Dakota, the state's Governor Jack Dalrymple announced an emergency evacuation of the Dakota Access Pipeline protesters' camp. They're effective immediately. But Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Chairman David Umbershaw II said the protesters would not stand down.
There's 7,000 people down there, and they're hunkered in pretty good. And so if force comes, it's not going to be good for anybody. And I don't think the governor wants that on his hands, and I don't think the Corps of Engineers wants that.
And President Obama sang Jingle Bells as he switched on the White House Christmas tree for the last time.
Hey! Jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in one horse open sleigh.
You may be glad to get out of there. We're looking at a week in the news. Trump's team, Tennessee wildfire, election recount, Fidel Castro. You can join us this hour. Have you lived through the burning of Gatlinburg? What about the Green Party asking for recount in three states now? Are the Democrats right to join that? Did Charlotte, North Carolina get it right not to charge the officer in that fatal shooting? And what are you thinking this week on the attack at Ohio State, the air crash with the Brazilian soccer team, the death of Fidel Castro? Let's look at this recount. We've got Scott calling from Buffalo, New York. Scott, you're on the air. What do you think about the Green Party saying recount?
Hi, Tom. I just want to say, I think Bernie Sanders said it best. I think he said, you know, she raised the money, she got the support, you know, and she can just have the recount. You know, she's gotten that. She has that ability, so she has the ability to do it.
You're talking about Jill Stein, head of the Green Party, candidate
yeah,
there.
Jill Stein. Mm-hmm. And I think what's important is just, I think it is worth noting that, you know, he's behind in 2 million votes in the popular vote. I think this whole talk of mandate is nonsense, but I think what's more important is to realize, you know, you can't just win with the electoral vote and say that's fine. I think it's important to say, like, you know, no matter what, a majority of Americans disagreed with me. So what was Hillary Clinton saying? What was Bernie Sanders saying? What were they saying that was really popular that still managed yet?
I don't know, Scott. You may see the world that way, but the fact is you can win the Electoral College and take the presidency. Donald Trump has and will. We can argue all day about what kind of mandate that is. Jack Beatty, what do you make of this recount effort? Jill Stein put out an appeal to raise money to recount in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. That will happen. But of course, I mean, we've got people responding here saying this is Democrat, because Democrats have offered support for some of that. This is sour grapes. They were very critical of Donald Trump, saying he wouldn't accept the results if they didn't go his way. And
Absolutely.
Now here's a recount, Jack.
Yes, and Green Party supporters are saying, why are you doing this to help the corrupt Democrats? You know, Dave Wasserman of the Cook Political Report, he called Jill Stein this week the Ralph Nader of 2016, and he points to things like this. Trump won Michigan by, Stein, I beg your pardon, won got Michigan by 50, got 50,000 votes in Michigan. Hillary lost in Michigan by 10,000. In Wisconsin, Stein got 31,000. Hillary lost much more narrowly than that. And similarly in Pennsylvania, of course, that's to assume that somehow those votes would have gone to Hillary. But it does put Ms. Stein, I think, in a sort of ironic position. She's standing up for the recount in three states where if she hadn't been on the ballot, at least you can make a kind of logical case, Hillary Clinton might have won.
People wanted to make a statement, and they did, though. Glenn Thrush, any chance of this recount changing anything with these three states now counting?
No. I mean, most chance would be in Michigan where the margin was small. But a couple of things here. First of all, Wasserman did the analysis. A bunch of other folks, including Nate Cohn at the New York Times, have also done analyses that show that, in fact, third-party candidates had a lesser impact on the outcome this year than in previous years, certainly than in 2000, certainly than in 1992 when Ross Perot ran. So Stein was not decisive, and a lot of those folks who voted for Stein were never, ever going to vote for Hillary Clinton in the first place. The other thing about this is, we really are getting down to what the strategic error of the Clinton campaign was. The thing that really decided this was this unexpected surge of Trump support in the exurbs, in rural areas and areas just outside the suburbs. The numbers that were not anticipated by pollsters, for instance, 40 straight public polls showed Hillary Clinton with a significant lead in Pennsylvania. She lost that state by 50,000 votes. Where the Clinton campaign lost was in Wayne County in Michigan, in Detroit, where they underperformed their numbers, in Milwaukee, where they significantly underperformed, and in the suburbs of Philadelphia. Jill Stein can do the recount all she wants. The Clinton folks, by the way, somewhat controversially, are participating in some of that. But the fact of the matter is, the reason why she lost by this collective 80,000 votes in these three battleground states is because her campaign had bad data and they did not get their voters out.
Well, it's putting pressure, though, on elections officials to say, look, we're out here trying to do our job and we're getting heat now from all sides. It was Wisconsin's Election Commission Chairman Mark Thompson said this week the recount would reassure his state's voters that the original outcome was correct. But he went on to criticize Donald Trump for casting doubt in the campaign on the whole system.
I think it's most unfortunate that the president-elect is claiming that there's huge problems with our system, and that's feeding what I call this conspiracy theory. I mean, it's just, you know, I personally, I'd like him to come down out of his Trump Tower and go up to Wautoma and Washira County and spend the time with the folks on the ground that are counting these votes.
Glenn, what about Donald Trump's tweet this week that he would have won if it wasn't for illegal voting that went on around the country? Millions of votes, he said, and everyone has jumped in to say there is no evidence to substantiate that claim. But there it was, and you can maybe hear some reaction to that in that Wisconsin official's comments.
I'm going to go so far, and I don't like to use this word, as to say he is lying. I define a lie as a misstatement, a willful misstatement of fact, when correct fact, when you have access to the correct information. We've had election officials from both parties verify the fact that there was not 3 million illegal voters who voted for this. There's no rational accounting for that. It's extrapolated from some previously debunked reporting. Every single person who has analyzed this says it's garbage. He has not repeated that. And I think what that really gets to is this question of selective reality and the role that we in the press are going to have to play over the course of the next 4 years at least in holding him accountable and to really get the public, Tom, to understand that these sorts of misstatements should not be taken lightly. You have it's one thing to make these comments, and it's bad enough in the home stretch of the campaign, particularly in the third debate when he was essentially saying that he might not honor the validity of a free and fair election. But when the president-elect of the United States is throwing around garbage numbers willfully with a political goal here, which is essentially to erase the fact that Hillary Clinton is accruing this substantial lead in the popular vote, I just think it's unacceptable, and I don't think we should sugarcoat it. If he's lying, we got to say it's a lie.
It wasn't the only head-turning tweet of the week. Another was on flag burning. He said people who burn the flag should pay a price for that. Some criminal charges or even losing their citizenship. We had Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell responding to that here after Donald Trump sent out the tweet.
That activity is a protected First Amendment right, a form of unpleasant speech. And in this country, we have a long tradition of respecting unpleasant speech. I happen to support the Supreme Court's decision on that matter.
Kelsey Snell, you're covering Congress. We're seeing a new style of presidential or presidential-elect communication here, even before Donald Trump is in the White House. How are congressional leaders thinking about what kind of interaction they're going to have? How are Republicans thinking about how they're going to work with President, when he's in the White House, Trump?
Well, you know, I have spoken with a lot of Republicans who say they are going through some serious soul searching about what their role is in challenging President-elect Trump once he takes office. It is a difficult position to be in, and I think a lot of times in Congress, there is a sense that you need to defend the president of your party and go to bat for that person no matter, you know, what the policy is. You saw some Democrats do that with President Obama on health care, where they maybe didn't agree entirely about all of the things that were included in the Affordable Care Act, but they voted for it anyway, and they were staunch supporters. It is different, though, when it comes down to challenging fundamental things like the First Amendment. And I think that you're going to see a lot of Republicans really struggle with how they respond. I think they're also going to struggle on things when, like spending. I've spoken with many people who have been deeply held deficit hawks who really worry that what Trump is talking about is anathema to conservative principles on cutting spending and, you know, and cutting government's role in everyday lives of people. It's not going to be a quick or even very a steady response. I think you're going to see people vacillate wildly about whether or not they're willing to challenge Trump. And I think it's something that we as reporters have a responsibility to kind of keep tabs on and point out to people, you know, when these Republicans are, you know, changing or altering their deeply held beliefs to accommodate things that Trump says that may or may not, you know, be in support of, you know, conservative principles.
Of course, he says, let's go a new way, and he doesn't seem to be any prisoner of anybody's principles, but his own assessment of how things are going. Of course, huge news late last week and the morning going on this week out of Cuba with the death of Fidel Castro at 90. What was it, 11 American presidents? He was a thorn in the side of, hero to many Cubans in Cuba, but also a very, very rough dictator once he was fully in power there. Interesting tape that was back in the news this week from way back in 1959. This is soon after taking power in Cuba. He was at Harvard University talking with students there. This is decades ago, before the full kind of Castro clampdown came to Cuba, talking to students about how fortunate they were, he said, to live in a democracy without experiencing the fears of oppression that Cubans had seen before Castro under the dictator Batista.
You are sure at all of your freedom, of your constitution. You are not worried of generals to take power by force. You are not worried by the army to take him power by force. And you have no idea what is that, what is to live without freedoms, under the fear, under the terror, without the right of election, of right of speaking.
A much younger Fidel Castro telling Americans they had no idea what it was like to live without freedoms and under fear. Kelsey, now with Castro gone and a new administration coming in, what do you see coming on U.S. foreign policy toward Cuba?
Well, we have seen, you know, some mixed responses. House Speaker Paul Ryan said his only response was to say that the cruelty and oppression should die along with Castro. And, you know, I think there are a lot of people who are in a wait-and-see mode about whether or not the kind of fits and starts of liberalizing the economy and some of the policies in Cuba will actually take hold more deeply now that Castro is gone. I don't know that we'll see any kind of major response in the near term, at least not from Congress.
Charlotte, North Carolina, there will be no charges in the shooting there of Keith Lamont Scott. This was the district attorney in Charlotte saying no. Brentley Vinson, the African-American police officer there, would not face charges. Witness accounts said that Scott was not armed, but police said there was a gun. Here was the district attorney.
Mr. Scott's gun, a Colt 380 semi-automatic, was recovered at the scene. It had one round in a chamber. The safety was off, and the gun was cocked.
That night, streets of Charlotte, protest.
Justice!
Glenn Thrush, you know, there are so many of these lined up. We've got more trials to come, some already underway. But here in Charlotte, no charges whatsoever. Does this just now recede as a blip in history?
I don't think it recedes as a blip in history. I think we're at this moment of incredible division in our country. And, you know, I think there's a substantial part of the country that still feels, African-American folks, who feel that they are unfairly targeted for this sort of thing. I can't speak to the individual merits of this particular case. But on the flip side, we've also had this rash of shootings of police officers who are either, you know, walking to and from work, sitting in their patrol cars. You know, I was in New York about a year and a half ago when two innocent cops were gunned down while they were sitting in their patrol cars. There's something really going on out there in the streets. And, you know, and I think the divisive nature of this last campaign really underscores the need for President-elect Trump and also Democrats in Congress to attempt to figure out pragmatic solutions to make sure this stuff isn't happening. And I would really, really hope that we can address both of these issues in a collective way as a country and not turn them into these polarizing political issues.
News breaking out of Wisconsin as we speak that Trump supporters have filed a federal lawsuit looking to halt Wisconsin's ongoing presidential election recount. And, of course, this week the news out of Gatlinburg and those unbelievable scenes there of fire coming into that beautiful, beautiful town at the entrance to the Great Smoky Mountains. Here was a woman on NBC confronted with a wall of flames.
Panic. That's all we had was panic. We could feel the heat coming off. It was nothing but red.
Jack Beatty, just riveting images coming out of there this week. Tornadoes across the south all the way into the end of November here. And Gatlinburg burning, just burning this beautiful town.
Burning of a town, yeah. And from what I've read, possibly arson. That coupled with drought conditions of apparently unprecedented or historic dimensions. Disturbing weather.
Disturbing weather and people wondering, is it a climate change effect right here as a beautiful town goes up in flames? Much more coming as the new administration's messages roll out toward the country, even before Inauguration Day. We're grateful to all three of you for being with us today to look at that and more. Kelsey Snell at the Washington Post covering Congress there. Kelsey, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Glenn Thrush at Politico, chief political correspondent there. Glenn, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here.
And Jack Beatty, great as always to have you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.